segregation along racial lines. With households suffering, in America's economic downswing of 2008, it was consumption that led the way. As demand fell, so did production and employment. In the Central Valley in California, which witnessed a collapse of 50% in home values, consumption was cut by 30%. Every kind of expenditure that could be postponed was cut back. For America's long-ailing motor vehicle industry, it was the coup de grace. Car and light vehicle sales plunged from an annual rate of 16 million units in 2007 to as few as 9 million per annum in 2009. By December 2008, it was clear that both Chrysler and General Motors would fail. In the early 21st century, GM was no longer the national totem that it had once been. Its total worldwide employment in 2007 was 266,000, compared with a peak of 853,000 in 1979. But as 2008 began, it was still the largest car company in the world. GM paid $476 million in salaries each month, as well as the health care and pension benefits for 493,000 retired workers. Its production operations generated $50 billion in orders for parts and services supplied by 11,500 vendors. In total, industry lobbyists claimed that around 4.5% of all U.S. jobs were supported by the auto industry, paying more than $500 billion annually in wages and generating more than $70 billion in tax revenues. On November 7, 2008, GM declared that, barring government aid, it would face insolvency by the summer of 2009. The imminent failure of GM and Chrysler was an exclamation point on the long-running decline of the American auto industry. One version of the American dream was dying. But Detroit's crisis sent shockwaves around the world. The future of GM's long-established UK and German divisions, Vauxhall and Opel, was in doubt. So too were Detroit's operations in Mexico. Under the NAFTA free trade system, interconnected production systems, known as value chains, had been stretched from one end of North America to the other. As a result, Mexico's dependence on the United States was overwhelming. In 2007, 80% of Mexico's exports were sent to the United States. As the American crisis hit, Mexico's GDP fell by almost 7%, a worse contraction even than during the homegrown financial crisis of 1995, the so-called tequila crisis. Mexico's non-oil exports fell by 28% between May 2008 and May 2009. Automotive exports fell by 50%. In the northern industrial cities of Ciudad Juarez and Tijuana, the great Maquiladora export processing centers, employment in manufacturing fell by more than 20%. Together with the surging violence of the drug wars, the recession led more than 100,000 desperate workers and their families to abandon Juarez. As unemployment surged north of the border, remittances dried up, and hundreds of thousands of migrants returned home, making the situation of the poorest Mexicans progressively more desperate. Meanwhile, the inflow of new foreign investment in Mexico halved, and the peso plunged in value from 11 to 15 to the dollar, driving up the cost of living. Nor was the pain confined to North America. For decades, GM's great global rival was Toyota, and 2008 would be the year in which Toyota claimed the title of the world's leading car producer. It paid a heavy price. In 2009, Japan was rocked by a Toyota shock, as its national champion reported its first loss in 70 years and cut global production by 22%. From a profit of $28 billion in 2007 to 2008, Toyota slid to a loss of $1.7 billion in 2008 to 2009. In the words of its president, Katsuaki Watanabe, "The change in the world economy is of a magnitude that comes once every 100 years. We are facing an unprecedented emergency." As inventories of unsold cars piled up in the United States and Europe, Japanese car exports fell by two-thirds. Japan's investment industries stopped in their tracks. Hitachi, the giant producer of capital goods and electronics, was worst hit, facing a record loss for a Japanese industrial company of $7.87 billion. Consumer electronics icon Sony announced a loss of $2.6 billion. Toshiba expected to lose $2.8 billion. Panasonic, $3.8 billion. All in all, in January 2009, Japan's economy contracted at a rate of 20% per annum, and exports by 50% year on year. The largest part of this was accounted for by a fall in exports to the United States, followed by Japan's immediate Asian neighbors China, Taiwan, and Korea, all of which were plunged into recession. As the shock of 2008 revealed, with supply chains synchronized to perfection, Factory Asia responded within a matter of weeks to any hesitation of demand in Europe and America. Nor were they the only ones to be hit. Germany suffered a 34% fall in exports between the second quarter of 2008 and 2009, with its machinery and transport equipment sector taking a deep dive. It was the most severe economic shock suffered by the Federal Republic since its foundation in 1949. As one bank economist remarked, one has to go back to the 1930s, during the Great Depression, to find comparably horrible figures. Meanwhile, emerging markets were hit too. Turkey, which had joined the club of rapidly growing economies after its financial stabilization in 2004, suffered a sudden and jarring stop. By the first quarter of 2009, Turkey's GDP was falling by 14.7% on an annualized basis. Unemployment rocketed from 8.6% in the summer of 2008 to 14.6% in the first winter of the crisis. It was the worst affected of any of the emerging markets outside Eastern Europe. Turkey had not seen a situation so bad as this since the disastrous financial crisis of 2001. Istanbul's stock market plunged by 54% between December 2007 and November 2008. What made the collapse of 2008 so severe was its extraordinary global synchronization. Of the 104 countries for which the World Trade Organization collects data, every single one experienced a fall in both imports and exports between the second half of 2008 and the first half of 2009. Every country and every type of traded goods, without exception, experienced a decline. If in manufacturing the downturn was in the volume of trade, the number of cars shipped or the number of cell phones exported, in commodities, the shock was to prices. In the worst 6 months of 2008, oil prices fell by more than 76%. That in turn wreaked havoc with the budgets of the petrostates. Saudi Arabia swung from a budget surplus of 23% of GDP in 2008 to a substantial deficit. Kuwait was rocked by the crisis at Gulf Bank, which faced losses on currency trades. But nowhere was worse affected than the boom town of Dubai. Driven by surging commodity prices, heavily backed by international banks such as RBS and Standard Chartered, Dubai's real estate sector had become the center of a global construction frenzy. By 2008, the city bristled with construction cranes. Its palatial malls boasted floor space four times the per capita level in the United States. In the autumn of 2008, the bubble burst. New credit was slashed. By February 2009, Dubai's rip-roaring six-year construction boom had come to a halt. Half of a portfolio of $1.1 trillion in construction projects being undertaken in the Gulf Cooperation Council was cancelled in a matter of months. Luxury cars were abandoned in droves as Western contract workers scuttled to the airport to escape debtors' prison. An airlift of charter flights repatriated tens of thousands of migrant guest workers to India. As both household consumption and business investment plummeted, of the 60 countries that supply the IMF with quarterly GDP statistics, 52 registered a contraction in the second quarter of 2009. Not since records began had there been such a massive, synchronized recession. Tens of millions of people were thrown into unemployment. Though it was dazed bankers with boxes of belongings stumbling out of office towers in London and New York that attracted the TV cameras, it was young, unskilled blue-collar workers who suffered the worst. In the United States, the epicenter of the crisis, the month-on-month fall in employment over the winter of 2008 to 2009, was breathtaking. In the worst period, the monthly rate of job losses topped 800,000. Among the African-American population, the surge was particularly dramatic, with unemployment rising from 8% in 2007 to 16% by early 2010. Young black workers were particularly hard hit, with their unemployment rate surging to 32.5% by January 2010. At the very bottom of the pile were young African-American men with no high school diploma. In New York City in 2009, their unemployment rate was more than 50%. Precisely how many people lost their jobs across the global economy depends on our guess as to joblessness among China's giant migrant workforce. But reasonable estimates range between 27 million and something closer to 40 million unemployed worldwide. The situation was clearly bad. But in historical terms, how bad was bad? Trying to find his bearings in the spring of 2009, Paul Krugman concluded that the situation was dire. But at least as far as the industrial economy of the United States was concerned, it was less grim than it had been in the Great Depression of the 1930s. It was, he quipped, only half a Great Depression. It was not a judgment that stood for long. As critics scrambled to point out, Krugman's assessment was deeply parochial. The Great Depression of the 1930s was not confined to the United States, and neither was the crisis that struck in 2008. On a global level, industrial output, stock markets, and trade were all falling at least as fast in 2008 to 2009 as they had in 1929. We now know that urgent and massive countermeasures would forestall the kind of agonizing depression that the world experienced in the early 1930s. But that relatively sanguine perspective depends on the safety of hindsight. In September 2008, the scale of the response was an index of the desperation felt by those at the epicenter of the crisis in the United States. Ben Bernanke at the Fed, Tim Geithner at the New York Fed, and Hank Paulson at the Treasury all recounted the experience as traumatic. After Lehman collapsed, Paulson confronted his staff with the prospect of an economic 9/11. On the morning of September 20th, the U.S. Treasury Secretary alerted Congress to the fact that unless they acted fast, $5.5 trillion in wealth would disappear by 2 p.m. They might be facing the collapse of the world economy within 24 hours. In private session with congressional leadership, Bernanke, who is not given to overstatement, warned that unless they authorized immediate action, we may not have an economy on Monday. As far as America was concerned, this was clearly an exaggeration. Bernanke was trying to scare Congress into action. But if one looks at data on international investment flows, the picture is truly astonishing. Across the world before the crisis hit, inflows and outflows of capital came to just under 33% of world GDP. The vast majority of this was accounted for not by transactions between the advanced world and emerging markets, but by flows between advanced economies. At the height of the crisis, between the last quarter of 2008 and the first quarter of 2009, those flows collapsed by 90% to less than 3% of global GDP. In the second half of 2008, capital flows between rich countries plunged from $17 trillion to barely more than $1.5 trillion. No other aggregate in the global economy was affected on anything like this scale or with this suddenness. It was as though a gigantic, stabilizing flywheel suddenly came crashing to a halt, sending a shuddering jolt through the entire financial system. In public, Ben Bernanke knew it was essential for him to keep a straight face. Financial panics have a substantial psychological component. Projecting calm, rationality, and reassurance is half the battle, he would later opine. But as an economist and an economic historian, Bernanke understood the scale of what he was up against. What threatened in 2008 wasn't 1929. What threatened was something even bigger and quite possibly even worse. As he was to affirm on several occasions afterward, for Bernanke, September and October of 2008 was clearly the worst financial crisis in global history, including the Great Depression. In the 1930s, there was no moment of such massive synchronization, no moment in which so many of the world's largest banks threatened to fail simultaneously. The speed and force of the avalanche was unprecedented. As Bernanke later admitted to the readers of his memoirs, it was overwhelming, even paralyzing to think too much about the high stakes involved, so I focused as much as I could on the specific task at hand. As events unfolded, I repressed my fears and focused on solving problems. Only as he neared the end of his second term was he ready to unwind. Looking back, it was like being in a car wreck. You're mostly involved in trying to avoid going off the bridge, and then later on you say, "Oh my God." Tim Geithner, from his vantage point at the New York Fed, gave a typically hard-boiled insight into his perspective on the struggle to save the financial system. I didn't have a way to explain the terror of those days until later, when I saw The Hurt Locker, the Oscar-winning film about a bomb disposal unit in Iraq. What we went through on interminable conference calls in fancy office buildings obviously did not compare with the horrors of war, but 10 minutes into the movie, I knew I had finally found something that captured what the crisis felt like. The overwhelming burden of responsibility, combined with a paralyzing risk of catastrophic failure, the frustration about the stuff out of your control, the uncertainty about what would help, the knowledge that even good decisions might turn out badly, the pain and guilt of neglecting your family, the loneliness and the numbness. There is no reason to doubt the sincerity of these professions. It was a fearful situation. But the metaphors, terrorist attack, car wrecks, and unexploded improvised explosive devices, are telling. They position the crisis-fighting team as first responders facing a compelling emergency. And they place us, their audience, by their side. Who would not root for the fatherly Ben Bernanke trying to keep the family car on the bridge, or Geithner's heroic bomb disposal team? Politics is set aside as we anxiously watch our heroes struggle to rescue us from disaster. There is no time to ask why this is happening. We are all in this together. But it is precisely with that assertion that a political economy of the crisis begins. Which system was it that needed to be saved in the autumn of 2008? Who was being hurt? Who was included in the circle of those who needed to be protected? And who was not? As the crisis spiraled toward September 2008, the first responders performed a substitution. It had all started with a predictable but devastating bursting of the housing bubble. That crisis was affecting millions of households on both sides of the Atlantic, but starting with the rash of bank failures and fund failures in the late summer of 2007, the real estate crisis was gradually displaced from the center of attention. What now mattered was the possible failure of an investment bank. By September 2008, it was no longer individual banks, but the entire financial system that had to be saved at all costs. It was entire markets and sectors, the repo market, ABCP, the mutual funds, that needed life support. It was the implosion of the financial system, imagined as something akin to a massive electrical power failure, that threatened the entire economy. It was crucial to fix Wall Street, so the slogan went, to help Main Street. The mantra was repeated in local idiom all over the world. And for the purposes of ongoing business activity, it clearly was crucial to maintain business credit. In September, even blue-chip businesses could not get short-term funding. McDonald's could no longer get an overdraft from Bank of America. Engineering giant GE and Harvard University were rumored to be having liquidity issues. But beyond such immediate rescue measures, did the all-out focus on the financial system really serve the interests of the real economy? Was the inability to borrow causing a failure of investment and thus the ongoing depression, or were the collapsed housing market and cash-strapped households curtailing economic activity such that there was no incentive to invest and thus no demand for loans? These might seem like academic questions. The bomb was ticking. The car was hurtling off the bridge. Amid a global catastrophe, did it really matter which way the arrow of causation was pointing? Amid the intensity of the financial crisis, why should anyone care? Because the decision made by the American crisis fighters to take those questions off the table and to give absolute priority to saving the financial system shaped everything else that followed. It set the stage for a remarkable and bitterly ironic inversion. Whereas, since the 1970s, the incessant mantra of the spokespeople of the financial industry had been free markets and light-touch regulation, what they were now demanding was the mobilization of all of the resources of the state to save society's financial infrastructure from a threat of systemic implosion, a threat they likened to a military emergency. Chapter 7. Bailouts. The ferocity of the financial crisis in 2008 was met with a mobilization of state action without precedent in the history of capitalism. Never before, outside wartime, had states intervened on such a scale and with such speed. It was a devastating blow to the complacent belief in the great moderation, a shocking overturning of prevailing laissez-faire ideology. To mobilize trillions of dollars on the credit of the taxpayer to save banks from the consequences of their own folly and greed violated maxims of fairness and good government. But given the risk of contagion, how could states not act? Having done so, however, how could they ever go back to the idea that markets were efficient, self-regulating, and best left to their own devices? It was a profound challenge to the basic idea that had guided economic government since the 1970s. It was all the more significant for the fact that the challenge came not from the outside. It was not motivated by some radical ideological turn to the left or the right. There was precious little time for thought or wider consideration. Intervention was driven by the financial system's own malfunctioning and the impossibility of separating individual business failure from its wider systemic repercussions. Martin Wolf, the Financial Times' esteemed chief economic commentator, dubbed March 14, 2008, the day the dream of global free market capitalism died. That was the day the Bear Stearns rescue was announced. It was only the beginning. Bailout battles were fought all along the contours of the integrated Atlantic financial economy, in the United States, Iceland, Ireland, Britain, France, Germany, the Benelux, Switzerland. The financial firepower deployed was immense, and accounting for it became a field of political argument in its own right. But whichever metrics we use, it is clear that there had never before been anything so extensive or massive in scale. Commitments were made in excess of $7 trillion. The main mechanisms for intervention were fourfold. 1. Loans to banks. 2. Recapitalization. 3. Asset purchases. And 4. State guarantees for bank deposits, bank debts, or even for the entire balance sheet. Everywhere the crisis struck, states were forced to take some combination of these measures. The agencies involved were central banks, finance ministries, and banking regulators. What summary statistics cast as cool enumerations were, in fact, frantic, improvised solutions that emerged from barely coordinated sessions of all-day, all-night problem-solving. As the crisis intensified, it put the financial and political resilience of states to the test. Broadly speaking, this produced four types of outcome, which reflect the degree of immersion in global finance, the resources of the states at risk, the shape of the governing elite, and the balance of power within the financial sector itself. In the most extreme cases, the crisis overwhelmed the state. Ireland and Iceland simply did not have the resources, the institutions, or the political capacities to deal with a gigantic shock to their overgrown financial sectors. They would suffer a comprehensive crisis, as would the worst-hit emerging market economies of Eastern Europe. Others were better placed. Despite having a grossly overgrown financial sector, Switzerland survived intact. It did so through early, intense, and unrelenting attention to its one failing megabank, UBS. Though it was never nationalized, it became, in effect, a ward of the state. The larger European states and those with less excessive banking systems, the UK, Germany, France, Belgium, and the Netherlands, presented a more mixed bag. Despite the scale of the crises they faced, they had the resources to cope. They attempted comprehensive organizational and financial solutions, including abortive proposals to coordinate a common European response to the crisis. but efforts to achieve consistency and coordination were undermined by national political calculation and the uncooperative behaviour of leading banks that fancied themselves large enough to survive without the humiliation of taking state aid. There was no spiralling disaster, but containing the crisis was hugely expensive and success was partial at best. Out of this trial of strength, the United States emerged as the one nation state with the capacity not only to backstop the biggest financial sector in the world, but also to impose a comprehensive solution. Not for nothing, America's crisis fighters liked to speak in military terms about big bazookas and shock and awe. Geithner went furthest in this respect. For inspiration, he invoked the war-fighting doctrine developed in the aftermath of the Vietnam debacle by America's chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Colin Powell. Strike with massive force and plan a clear route out. It was an analogy that had first been invoked by Larry Summers at the time of the Mexico financial crisis in 1994. Now it became Geithner's mantra. For him, the Powell Doctrine applied to international finance meant the overwhelming use of force with a clear strategy for resolution. As Geithner insisted, there is more risk and greater cost in gradualism than in aggressive action. For Geithner and his cohorts, it was clear that swift and decisive action paid dividends. Compared with the disastrous performance of the European economy, the United States was set back on track. The leadership of American finance renewed itself. Even when viewed narrowly in accounting terms, many of the Treasury and Fed support programs made a profit for the American taxpayer. The benefits of preventing a second Great Depression were vast. By contrast with the European experience, it is not hard to see how this self-congratulatory American narrative gained purchase. But its economic merits are not so obvious as its proponents presume, and it offered no comfort to the advocates of laissez-faire. Gone were the days when economic policy was about shrinking the state to set free the spontaneous order of market liberty. No longer did wisdom lie in devising predictable rules to curtail the arbitrary discretion of policymakers. Economic policy, modelled on warfare, was a matter of will, vigilance, tactical nous, and firepower. And despite the populist appeal of the military rhetoric, there was a political price to pay. The crisis fighting of 2008 to 2009 scrambled American politics. The Bush administration lost the backing of much of the Congressional Republican Party. The crisis snapped the fragile bond between the GOP's managerial big business elite and its right-wing mass base. As the popular wing of the party, backed by maverick oligarch donors, moved increasingly toward indignant anti-establishment opposition, mainline conservatives like Bernanke and Paulson were left to complain that it was not they who left the party, but the party that left them. The Bush administration's crisis-fighting effort was carried by the Democratic Party's majorities in Congress. That contradiction would be resolved by Barack Obama's election victory on November 4, 2008, only weeks after the crisis reached its peak. But the fracture of the American right would in due course have profound consequences both for America and for the wider world. In 2007, the best hope of the authorities was still that the private sector might rescue itself. J.P. Morgan's consortium of 1907 was the stuff of Wall Street legend. In late October 2007, with the help of the U.S. Treasury, the three largest banks, Citigroup, Bank of America, and J.P. Morgan Chase, agreed to collaborate in creating a so-called Master Liquidity Enhancement Conduit that would help to stabilize the market for mortgage-backed securities and revive the ABCP market. Not surprisingly, Treasury Secretary Paulson loved the idea. But any private sector arrangement was vulnerable to problems of collective action. Though bankers detested government intervention, they also wanted to avoid the stigma of joining a cartel of ailing firms, especially one including Citigroup, whose balance sheet was particularly toxic. When major global competitor HSBC announced that it would absorb the full amount of $45 billion in losses suffered by its SIVs onto its balance sheets, its largest American rivals could not be seen to be settling for a second-best option. By December 2007, the private bad bank plan had collapsed. When collective action failed, the state could step in, acting as a matchmaker-in-chief, brokering takeover deals between individual banks. In Britain in 2008, the Scottish conglomerate HBOS would be sold off to Lloyds Bank, with encouragement from Downing Street. Germany's number two bank, Dresdner, would be amalgamated with Commerzbank, the number three. As both deals would reveal, the risk was that the bank that was in trouble would pull its rescuer down with it. In the United States, the amalgamations began in earnest with Bear Stearns, which came to the point of failure on the night of March 13th and 14th, 2008. If it had unloaded its portfolio of $200 billion in asset-backed securities and CDO at fire sale prices, the effect would have been catastrophic. It would have forced all the other banks to recognize crippling losses, spreading the panic. To the relief of the Treasury and the Fed, J.P. Morgan was interested in buying out Bear. Its hard-charging CEO, Jamie Dimon, was confident that his robust balance sheet put him in a position to safely pick over the carcass. But to finalize the deal, Dimon needed the right inducement. Under the emergency powers provided by Section 13(3) of the Fed's statutes, $30 billion in the most toxic assets were taken off Bear's books by an SIV funded by the New York Fed. Then, at 5 a.m. on the morning of March 14th, with the repo markets closed to Bear, the New York Fed lent $12.9 billion to J.P. Morgan, which J.P. Morgan then lent to Bear. After that, the die was cast. J.P. Morgan initially agreed to pay the laughable price of $2 per share for what was left of Bear. This compared with a valuation of $159 per share only 1 year earlier. When Bear's shareholders protested, the price was raised to $10 per share. Whether at $2 or $10, J.P. Morgan was confident it would make a profit. The Fed's actions forestalled what might have been a disruptive and chaotic bankruptcy, but the inducements that J.P. Morgan had extracted were debatable, to say the least. Paul Volcker, the legendary ex-chairman of the Fed, would characterize them as extending to the very edge of its lawful and implied powers. Strict advocates of moral hazard logic would forever after argue that it was the Bear rescue that set up the Lehman disaster. With one investment bank having been rescued, Lehman's management felt safe. A solution for their problems would be found too. They could afford to take their time finding the best possible deal, an attitude that would cost them dearly. Whether it was legal or wise, rescuing investment banks by means of obscure balance sheet transactions was a technical business that could be kept out of the political headlines. That changed with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. As the indispensable government-sponsored backdrop to the American housing market, they were at the center of one of the most formidable political networks in Washington. By the summer of 2008, with private securitization stalled, they were also responsible for backstopping 75% of new mortgages in the United States. The vast bulk of the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac balance sheet consisted of top-quality conforming mortgages. If they had had conventional balance sheets, they ought to have been able to ride out the storm. The problem was, they did not. In June 2008, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac held MBS valued at $1.8 trillion and guaranteed another $3.7 trillion on the basis of shareholder equity, which in the case of Fannie Mae came to only $41.2 billion and in the case of Freddie Mac to $12.9 billion. It was a leverage ratio that would have made even the boldest investment banker blush. It was conceivable only because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were government-sponsored enterprises. In the summer of 2008, the meaning of that term was going to be put to the test. Allowing for only minimal losses, the capital of both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac would be completely wiped out. If they folded, they would take down the last remaining lenders in the mortgage market and put in doubt the credit of the United States. They would put in jeopardy a huge portfolio of securities widely held by foreign investors. In the summer of 2008, foreign investors held $800 billion in debt issued by the GSEs. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were, as the influential blogger Brad Setzer quipped, too Chinese to fail. Desperate to gain a grip on the situation, in the spring of 2008, Hank Paulson's Treasury began to broker a deal between congressional Democrats and Republicans that would give the federal government the powers necessary to overhaul the mortgage giants. But over the summer, Congress dragged its heels. The Republicans were uncooperative, and the Democrats insisted that if they were to carry the bill, it must include support for struggling homeowners and the transfer of block grants to hard-hit states to buy up foreclosed properties. By mid-July, the situation was becoming critical. Given the scale of the crisis and the opacity of the GSE's financial situation, the capital injection might need to be huge. The Treasury favored an authorization limited only by the federal government's borrowing ceiling, putting the full financial clout of the American state behind the GSE. As Paulson famously put it to the Senate Banking Committee, if you've got a squirt gun in your pocket, you may have to take it out. If you've got a bazooka and people know you've got it, you may not have to take it out. Paulson's request was meant to sound impressive, and his bazooka comment echoed around the world. The U.S. Treasury Secretary was desperate to reassure foreign bondholders. Beijing was increasingly alarmed. In his memoirs, Paulson recorded, I was talking to them, Chinese ministers and officials, regularly because I didn't want them to dump the securities on the market and precipitate a bigger crisis. And so when I went to Congress and asked for these emergency powers to stabilize Fannie and Freddie, and I was getting the living daylights beaten out of me by our Congress publicly, I needed to call the Chinese regularly to explain to the People's Bank of China, listen, this is our political system. This is political theater. We will get this done. And I didn't have quite that much certainty myself, but I sure did everything I could to reassure them. The Chinese might be excused their confusion. The political theater being played in Washington, D.C. was new and strange. A conservative, free-market administration led by businessmen was proposing unlimited state spending to nationalize a large part of the housing finance system. The Republican electorate was outraged by the thought of assisting undeserving mortgage borrowers and the New Deal machinery that had aided and abetted their fecklessness. But to Paulson, the systemic imperative was obvious, and President Bush stood behind him. It was a tremendous act of political courage, Paulson gushed. It was as if, in the last days of his administration, the president were suddenly switching sides, supporting Democrats and opposing Republicans on matters that went against the basic principles of his administration. But he was determined to do what was best for the country. Paulson was registering a basic rift within American conservatism. The right wing of the party could not be counted on to give support to measures that were unpopular and distasteful, but were clearly necessary to save the system. Paulson recognized that the authorization he was asking for was unprecedented. I don't know if any executive branch agency had ever before been given the authority to lend to or invest in an enterprise in an unlimited amount. All I could do was argue that the extraordinary and unpredictable nature of the situation warranted the authority in this case. He also knew that it was only the Democrats, the party with relatively less inhibition about expanding the scope of government, who were willing to go along with this logic of absolute and unlimited necessity, dictated not by a national security emergency, but by a financial crisis. Paulson's extraordinary plenipotentiary authorization to rescue Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac passed Congress on July 26th, with three-quarters of House Republicans voting against. It was signed into law on July 30th. The White House thought it best to forego the usual festive Oval Office ceremony. There was no reason to goad the Republicans and no time to lose. With a team recruited from Morgan Stanley on a pro bono basis, the Treasury plunged into weeks of forensic investigation and negotiations with the GSE's failed regulators. The results were dispiriting. Both of the GCSEs were insolvent. Liquidity support would not be enough. On Sunday, September 7, 2008, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were placed under conservatorship. It was nationalization in all but name. If necessary, the Treasury would replenish their capital to make up any gap between assets and liabilities up to an initial maximum of $100 billion each. The Fed provided credit lines and undertook to buy whatever MBS the ailing GSEs needed to offload. It wasn't so much a bazooka as the nuclear option. The crucial effect of this intervention was to reassure bondholders, especially those abroad, that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac would not fail. Despite the machinations of Russia, the breakdown of America's government-sponsored mortgage machine did not spill over into a global crisis. But the political fallout was dire, and it had serious implications for the future course of the crisis. On the right wing of the Republican Party, fully mobilized for the hotly contested presidential election, the nationalization of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac unleashed a firestorm. The Treasury did its best to ward off allegations of cronyism by imposing a punitive dividend for the capital it contributed, wiping out the GSE's existing shareholders. The American Bankers Association rallied to the administration, calling on Republicans to support the rescue effort. But it was immediately countered by the conservative Club for Growth, a key right-wing lobby group funded by the Koch brothers. House leader John Boehner and former Speaker Newt Gingrich spoke out against Paulson's bailout. John McCain personally was thought to favor a rescue, but on August 29th, he nominated the populist Alaskan governor Sarah Palin as his vice presidential running mate. Palin did not have coherent views on the GSEs or the financial crisis, but her bluff persona fired up the passions of the Republican base. As the crisis deepened, the Bush administration was terrified that they might find themselves facing an insurgency from within their own party, led by a presidential candidate on the warpath against bailouts. What made the Republican brush fire so worrying was that by early September it was clear that the rescue of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac was only the first round, and that the next phase of the battle would be decided not in Washington, but on Wall Street. For months, the Treasury had been anxiously watching as Lehman Brothers looked for a buyer. By the second week of September, options were running out. Talks with a potential Korean suitor had stalled. In frantic negotiations hosted by Geithner's New York Federal Reserve and personally overseen by Paulson, the search for a private sector solution failed. The culminating moment came on the weekend of September 13th and 14th. What exactly happened in those 48 hours will remain forever a matter of controversy. What is beyond dispute is that Bank of America, the giant commercial bank that had been expected to act as the white knight for Lehman, bought Merrill Lynch instead. Merrill was bigger than Lehman. It, too, was heavily exposed to the real estate bust. Like Lehman, it was an investment bank that could not function without access to the repo market. After Lehman, it would certainly have been the next to fail, but unlike Lehman, Merrill's management was nimble and saved its bank by pushing for direct talks with Bank of America. It was well known that Bank of America CEO Ken Lewis had long wanted to emulate Citigroup in integrating an investment bank with his commercial banking business. On the desperate weekend of September 13th and 14th, 2008, Bank of America's hundreds of billions of retail deposits guaranteed by the FDIC were one part of the financial system that was not running. That funding base gave Bank of America the platform to buy out Merrill Lynch. But on what terms? On the face of it, Merrill was a prize. One of the biggest names on Wall Street, at the end of 2007 it was valued at $150 billion, with $1.02 trillion in assets and more than 60,000 employees worldwide. But given the potential losses on its books and its precarious wholesale funding, what was Merrill worth in September 2008? In the event, under huge pressure from Paulson and Bernanke, Bank of America paid $50 billion. $29 per share, a third of what Merrill had recently been worth, but 40% more than its market valuation the previous week. After Bank of America took Merrill, for Lehman, the last remaining hope was a transatlantic deal with the British bank Barclays, where the expat American Bob Diamond formerly of Morgan Stanley and Credit Suisse, was calling the shots. But Prime Minister Gordon Brown and Chancellor Alastair Darling refused to loosen regulations to allow the takeover to go ahead without full shareholder approval and without commitments of support from the US Treasury. If Bank of America had chosen Merrill, what was wrong with Lehman? They told Paulson that London did not want to import America's cancer. The basic question is why the options for Lehman were so narrow. Why were the Fed and the Treasury unwilling to sweeten the Lehman deal in the way that they had J.P. Morgan's takeover of Bear Stearns? Why, following the failure of the private option, was some other kind of backstop not worked out, of the kind that they would provide so liberally in the weeks to come? Geithner, Paulson and Bernanke have all insisted that the question is otiose. The problem was not that the Treasury and the Fed lacked the will, but that they lacked the means. The Lehman collapse was not the result of a deliberate intention on the part of the authorities. We hadn't done it on purpose, Geithner insisted. We had run up against the limits of our authority and the fears of the British regulators. The Fed could not lend to Lehman, Bernanke maintains, because the Fed lends only against good collateral to solvent banks. Lehman was insolvent, and, due to the nature of its investment banking business, its lack of depositor base and alternative income streams, it lacked the collateral. But these are retrospective justifications. At the time, Lehman's failure was seen as the result of a deliberate decision and a welcome one. On September 17th, Democratic Congressman Barney Frank declared in a hearing with Treasury officials that Monday, September 15th, the day of Lehman's failure, would long be celebrated as Free Market Day. Frank was joking, but others were not. As one of Paulson's assistants remarked, September 15th felt like a good day at the Treasury. They had let markets do their work. A New York Times editorial declared that it was oddly reassuring that Lehman had been allowed to fail. The Wall Street Journal congratulated Paulson on not blinking. The government had to draw a line somewhere. For Geithner at the New York Fed, this was no comfort. We hadn't chosen to draw a line. We had been powerless, not fearless. We had tried but failed to prevent a catastrophic default. On this interpretation of the crisis, Geithner would go on to base an entire program of state building. If in 2008 what had been missing were adequate state powers of intervention, the answer was to equip the Fed and the Treasury with the right tools. What Geithner could not admit is the possibility that Hank and Ben had, in fact, made a mistake, that they might have underestimated the severity of the fallout that Lehman's failure would cause, or that Paulson, as a Republican Treasury Secretary, might, in fact, have been constrained by politics. But this is what subsequent forensic reconstruction suggests. The best available contemporary evidence, rather than the self-justifications that the actors fashioned for themselves after the catastrophic consequences of Lehman's failure became apparent, suggests that the basic constraint on the Lehman rescue was Paulson's refusal, from the outset, to consider another bailout. British Chancellor Alastair Darling was in frequent contact with New York throughout the critical weekend. His perspective is telling. What was worrying was that it was becoming more evident that the US Treasury was reluctant to provide the financial support to make the deal work. I was not entirely surprised. I didn't think he had enough political capital to persuade the Republicans to nationalize another bank. It was a judgment that would be borne out 2 weeks later in the desperate battle to pass the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP. Though it was Paulson who took the lead in the Lehman talks in New York, from Washington, Bernanke was fully in agreement. The Fed was notably uncooperative in the desperate efforts of Lehman's management to buy time. Contrary to the impression created by Bernanke's retrospective testimony, the Fed concertedly pushed Lehman toward bankruptcy. The agreement made at the time was that ending uncertainty by means of bankruptcy would help to calm the markets. It is easy to say with hindsight, but it was a spectacular error of judgment. The scale of that error became clear within hours, as the shockwave from the Lehman failure impacted the American and the world economy. A day later, Paulson, Bernanke, and Geithner had to face the question of what to do about the insurance giant AIG. Here, too, their first impulse was to look for a private solution, with J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs leading frenetic discussions throughout Monday, September 15th. But by 7 p.m., any hope of a private rescue had evaporated. When the bailout team had reached a similar conclusion about Lehman 24 hours earlier, they had started preparing for bankruptcy. This time, the conclusion was the opposite. The financial markets would not withstand a second shock, and AIG's level of interconnectedness through derivatives, repo, and securities lending was even greater than that of Lehman. Letting AIG fail would, in the words of one Wall Street player, have been an extinction-level event. Instead, the Fed stepped in. As it had done with Bear Stearns, the Fed declared a Section 13(3) emergency. The New York Fed would offer a secured credit facility of up to $85 billion. On the early afternoon of Tuesday, September 16th, Fed security personnel rushed to the offices of AIG at 80 Pine Street in Lower Manhattan to gather up tens of billions of dollars of share certificates to serve as collateral. With the deeds to the world's second-largest insurance company safely stashed in the vaults of the New York Fed, the first phase of the rescue was announced at 3:30 p.m. The Fed backstopped AIG's credit default swap portfolio and its securities lending business. In exchange, it would take stock in AIG and its subsidiaries that would give the U.S. government a 79.9% equity stake in AIG's global insurance business. Following the template established with the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac nationalization, the deal inflicted a huge loss on AIG's existing shareholders. The securities lending business was unwound, with the New York Fed purchasing from AIG its depreciated portfolio of MBS, enabling it to pay off its securities lending counterparties. Most generous of all was the resolution of the CDS portfolio, which was accomplished by buying out the dangerous CDO on which AIG had written insurance. In effect, together with the collateral they had already claimed from AIG, the counterparties received payment at 100% of par on $62.2 billion in toxic mortgage-backed securities, the market value of which was closer to $27.2 billion. How little they would have been worth if AIG had been driven into bankruptcy is anyone's guess. In any case, the subsidy to the counterparties and their clients clearly ran into the billions. Nor was it only the American financial system that benefited. In the course of the bailout, the Fed made sure to leave in place the insurance contracts that AIG had offered to European banks to provide regulatory relief. If they had been voided, the Americans estimated that the European banks would have faced calls for at least $16 billion in additional capital. For fear of shouting fire in a crowded theater, the New York Fed later told Congress, it thought it best not even to mention this potential fallout from AIG's crisis to European regulators. If systemic stability was the goal, the kind of improvisations that had let Lehman fail and rescued AIG would not suffice. Having realized the scale of what they were up against, Bernanke and Paulson decided on September 17th that they must appeal to Congress for additional resources and the authority to use them. Paulson knew it was a serious political risk, but they were now faced with the collapse of the entire Wall Street system, and the resources at their disposal to meet it were stretched to the limit. With money hemorrhaging out of the money market funds, the Treasury made the extraordinary decision on September 19th to offer a guarantee to any fund willing to pay an insurance fee with the coverage to be backed by $50 billion in the Exchange Stabilization Fund. It was another improvisation. The Exchange Stabilization Fund was a creation of the New Deal era. It was established in 1934 to enable FDR's Treasury to manage the exchange rate of the dollar after the abandonment of the gold standard. The fund was tiny compared with the scale of the trillion-dollar cash pools that were running in September 2008, but using it to back an insurance fund allowed it to be leveraged, and, more important, it was the only pot of money immediately available to the Treasury. Meanwhile, Morgan Stanley and Goldman, the two investment banks left standing, were under immense funding pressure. 1 week after Lehman, they were rescued by the transparent expedient of redesignating them as commercial bank holding companies, so that they might benefit from the protection of FDIC deposit insurance. But that only increased the burden on the FDIC, which had problems of its own. On September 25th, the FDIC closed, broke up, and sold off Washington Mutual. With $244 billion in mortgages on the balance sheet, WaMu was the largest commercial bank in American history to fail. J.P. Morgan promptly snapped up WaMu's network of 2,239 retail branches and their deposits. Nor was J.P. Morgan the only buyer that could see the prizes on offer in the giant fire sale. The Japanese bank Mitsubishi was poised to rescue Morgan Stanley by taking a 20% stake. Warren Buffett was about to prop up Goldman Sachs with a $5 billion capital injection. But both deals were contingent on the promise of a government backstop. On September 20th, the Treasury sent Congress a three-page legislative proposal asking for authority to spend up to $700 billion to stabilize securities markets. After the unlimited bailout authorization for the GSEs, the Treasury was now asking to spend the equivalent of the entire U.S. defense budget on bad mortgage securities. But what was truly audacious about Paulson's bill was the nature of the power he was asking for. As the three crucial sentences of the bill read, "The Secretary is authorized to purchase and to make and fund commitments to purchase on such terms and conditions as determined by the Secretary, mortgage-related assets from any financial institution having its headquarters in the United States. The Secretary's authority to purchase mortgage-related assets under this Act shall be limited to $700 billion outstanding at any one time. Decisions by the Secretary pursuant to the authority of this Act are non-reviewable and committed to agency discretion, and may not be reviewed by any court of law or any administrative agency." Paulson was asking for legal carte blanche. Sketchy though it was, the proposal did not come out of the blue. Already, in mid-April 2008, Paulson and a Treasury team had met with Bernanke and his staff to discuss what they called a break-the-glass memo outlining different options for emergency action. They had considered large-scale guarantees for mortgages, but had shied away because the liability was uncertain and potentially huge. Recapitalization was a more direct way of intervening in a bank. It was also efficient. Every dollar of bank capital was leveraged. So a dollar of government capital would support 10, 20, or 30 times as much in lending. But recapitalization was rejected on political grounds. Paulson had no desire to go down in history as the Treasury Secretary who nationalized America's banking system. And even if Paulson had been willing to pay the personal price, an open call for government recapitalization would never have passed Congress. The Republicans would have voted en bloc against nationalization, and without bipartisan cover, the Democrats could not take the risk. Already in the spring of 2008, the Treasury team thus decided that asset purchases were the path of least resistance. Buying debts did not involve ownership of banks. It did not raise issues of control or corporate governance. It could all be done through the market. An auction mechanism could be used to determine the price. It was also admittedly slow-moving and expensive. $700 billion would cover barely more than half the outstanding subprime securitization. It wasn't the perfect solution. But after Lehman, AIG and WaMu, the Treasury and the Fed were desperate. They needed something that might pass, and pass quickly. Legislation that would ordinarily spend months in Congress needed to be passed in a matter of days. It was hyperdrive blitzkrieg, one lobbyist flippantly remarked, and it ran into trouble from the start. As Geithner recorded in his memoirs, congressional leaders, who had seemed shell-shocked but willing to act after Hank and Ben warned them about a second depression, now just seemed angry. "This proposal is stunning and unprecedented in its scope, and lack of detail, I might add," said Senate Banking Committee Chairman Chris Dodd. "I can only conclude that it is not just our economy that is at risk, but our Constitution as well." Dodd was a Democrat, and at least willing to consider the possibility of action. Republicans were less measured. Jim Bunning of Kentucky described the proposal as un-American financial socialism. Ted Poe, a Texas Republican, lambasted the plan. New York City fat cats expect Joe Sixpack to buck up and pay for all of this nonsense. Putting a financial gun to the head of every American is not the answer. By 2008, the Bush administration had a credibility issue when it came to emergency powers. "This is eerily similar to the rush to war in Iraq," declared Representative Mike McNulty, a Democrat from upstate New York. "We have been told repeatedly by this administration that the economy is fundamentally sound, and then all of a sudden they say the economy is going to collapse. That is unacceptable." Representative Pete Stark, Democrat from California, recalled how General Colin Powell, Bush's Secretary of State during the Iraq crisis, had tried to scare us some years ago by saying if we didn't vote for an ill-conceived war, we'd see terrorists on the streets. In the Financial Times, the economist and blogger Willem Bouter remarked that Paulson's bill read, "as though it was personally written by Dick Cheney, the prince of absolute executive authority, no checks and balances, no accountability, no recourse. No administration that brought us WMD in Iraq and the torture camps of Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib should expect anything but hysterical giggles in response to such a request." The left-wing filmmaker Michael Moore weighed in with an incendiary email to his mass following entitled, "The Rich Are Staging a Coup This Morning." As the British journalist Paul Mason remarked, Paulson's cack-handed proposal triggered an accidental synergy between the right-wing populist opposition to the bailout and the left-liberal stance. History would prove it to be more than accidental. In the midst of a presidential election, it was explosive stuff. The Democratic candidate, Barack Obama, was not the problem. Not only was Obama backed by an economics team recruited by way of Robert Rubin and the Hamilton Project, but his personal entourage included top bankers from UBS and Merrill Lynch. The problem was John McCain. If McCain threw in his lot with the rebel Republicans, it would not only threaten the proposed legislation, it would force the Democratic presidential campaign into a devastatingly unpopular choice. House Republican leader John Boehner was not helpful. One-third of the Republican Congressional Party was so ideologically opposed to any more bailouts that there was no hope of their support. Another third were in tight races and could not risk alienating their base. "You were being asked to choose between financial meltdown on the one hand and taxpayer bankruptcy and the road to socialism on the other, and you were told to do it in 24 hours. Representative Jeb Henseling of Texas, head of the Conservative Republican Study Committee, indignantly told journalists. Rising stars from the right wing of the Republican Party, like Paul Ryan of Wisconsin and Eric Cantor of Virginia, rallied around the resistance to the Bush administration's sellout. With the Republicans deeply divided, on September 24th, McCain suspended his campaign and announced he was returning to Washington to take the lead in fixing the crisis. In the Treasury and the White House, this caused panic. The markets were in a febrile mood. No one knew what McCain had in mind. What was certain was that it would stir up the Republican base. Startled at the news, Paulson screamed into his Motorola, demanding that the White House get a grip on their candidate. Bernanke was so alarmed by the intensity of the political power play that he thought it better to withdraw to the safety of the Fed. In the end, it took interventions by the White House Chief of Staff and major Republican donors, including Henry Kravitz,